opener music. Good afternoon. It's Friday, December 4th, and this is Mike Vandervoort. I'm hosting Drive Through today, and beautiful day here in Georgia, chilly but sunny, which I'm grateful for. It rained all week, but nice heading into a nice weekend. Our guest today, I'm stuttering. Our guest today is Kate Bischoff. Kate, welcome back to Drive Through. How are you today?
I'm good, and I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
We love having you on. I know I think the last time you were on, I also hosted the show, and I really enjoyed the conversation. So it was it's nice to have you back. I think, however, since you were last on, we were still doing the what keeps you up at night questions, and now we're mm-hmm. doing a failure to success sort of story arc on the show, trying to talk to people, in some cases practitioners, about a thing they learned and maybe failed at and learned and then turned into a success. But we're gonna pivot that a little bit for you today, as we talked about on the pre-show. I think one of the things that you and I discussed real quick is that sometimes in your role as an attorney to employers, you often have to kind of give people news they may or may not like to hear, right? So that massive challenges sometimes in delivering advice and all that sort of thing. So let's talk about how you as an attorney, or you know, some version of this. Let's talk about how you as an attorney may help your clients fail or succeed. You got some stuff to share with us on that?
Sure. I mean, one of the things I look at is, you know, I look at an organization as a whole as my client, but the primary person, whether it be an internal attorney to the organization or the vice president of HR or HR manager, I look at as I am their advisor and someone who comes to them with information that they may not want to hear, but it's also a bit of my job to help them look good to their organization. So if a client calls me because they're concerned about the classification of a worker under the FLSA, you know, it's my job to say, well, here's what we think the law will say, because you can't always be 100% sure, especially under the FLSA. But we can say, here's what we anticipate what this is going to be, because this individual who's contacted me certainly has talked to somebody else, because they, first of all, they need to get authorization to talk to me, because I don't come cheap. But they also are looking for advice to help bolster their position or, you know, find a way that's contrary so that they can look good in their organization. And oftentimes that means that I'm giving them advice that the organization as a whole doesn't want to hear or that contradicts what they've told the organization. So I come to them kind of as hopefully a friend and confidant, and I think my clients would say that. And then, you know, try to fashion the message to be a way that they can communicate it that doesn't come across as, you know, threatening or, you know, the little, I remember, what's the chicken who the sky is falling. You know, it's not
Chicken
a
Little.
Message like that. Yeah, Chicken Little. There we go. We're not crying Chicken Little and saying the sky is falling, but how do we, you know, craft a message that involves a balancing of risk and, you know, giving them practical advice to go move forward. So sometimes that involves like a lot of, we haven't been doing this right, but here's how we can fix this, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not sure if it's out or if it's going to be out soon. And I'm on a panel with SHRM, expertise panel, they call them. And, you know, every now and then they send us some questions where they're looking for quotes or about a topic or something in HR magazine or whatever. And so one of the things I know they're working on was sort of a series of questions. You know, as a client or as an HR practitioner, what do you look for in an attorney? And they had like two or three different specific questions around that. And my answer, I just answered one of them. My answer was I want somebody who knows what they're doing, but who's also willing to tell me not just what the law says I should know, but what I need to know. Like what you would do if you were my attorney, I would say to you, Kate, if this was your business, what would you do? Right? That's the kind
right.
of question I ask. And because I want to hear not just the law, I want to hear an opinion. And what you're, mm-hmm. I think the side that you're saying is a lot of times you get clients with a deaf ear. They just don't want to hear it, right? They just,
right.
It's, they think you're wrong. They just don't want to deal with the reality that you brought them. How do you help somebody over that hump? Is it persuasion, or do they have to taste medicine and know it tastes bad?
Well, I hope they don't have to taste the medicine, because I don't want to be in a position with a client to say, na 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 boo boo, I told you so, right? Like, I don't want to be in that position. But I think often when I'm looking at a client who is in a non-compliant position and they think that they've been doing something right and they want to continue doing it that way, it's up to me to come up with some kind of creative solution that brings them into compliance with still meeting their goals. And that's why if I was an HR professional looking for an attorney, I'd want someone who was intellectually curious about my business, because it's not just, you know, this is what the law is and this is what you must do. It's how does this is what you must do work for your business? And so if you need to be doing X to comply under the law, how do we get you to X that satisfies your business goals, even if what your business goals might seem to not necessarily align? Does that make sense? I mean, I pride myself, which is, you know, one of the deadly sins, but I pride myself on being someone who can look just outside of the law as to how can we come up with some creative solutions that are not just red letter law. And balancing that risk. And if I know more about your business, we develop a relationship after time, I can help come to that solution with you.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think as a, you know, from the other side, as an HR practitioner back in the old days when HR was coming out of the personnel era and merging into human resources, and, you know, this is the knock HR gets a lot, right, is that we're just, you know, we're Nazis and all we worry about is trying to not get sued, right? So, you know, that used to mm-hmm. be, at one time in my own career, that was my arsenal, right? We got to do this so we don't get sued. And they don't listen to HR people any more than they listen to attorneys in the operations side. I mean, I'm joking, but I mean, the reality is, you know, I think in business, you know, you're going to, at some point, I mean, it's not like you're going to get sued anyway. And so you just do whatever the hell you want, right? But sometimes you have to, you know, I mean, there's interests you have to balance, right? The needs of the business, mm-hmm. the employees, the practicalities of your resources, the advice you get from your attorneys. And people have to kind of blend that all together and come to a point that they can live with, right?
Right. And that, you know, I'll use myself as an example. I swear like a sailor. And in yep. some workplaces, in the old school HR folks, the, you know, the quote-unquote real evil HR lady, not the Susan Lucas version, but the real, you know, the stereotypical, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't work well with that individual because they think I'm probably, I'm way outside the lines and I'm, you know, subjecting them to a lawsuit. But, you know, foul language doesn't subject someone to a sexual harassment lawsuit. So I can't change who I am, and my business goal is to work with people who I enjoy working with, and my clients are my friends. So, you know, I want to balance who I am, what my business needs are. You know, I need to feed two little boys, and I want to make sure that my clients can do that same thing. And if we have that kind of relationship where we're close confidants, we can come up with those solutions. And sometimes it takes a lot of brainstorming and it takes a lot of, well, have you thought of this situation? But ultimately we come to that solution, which is practical for the business. It meets the needs of the individuals. And, you know, every once in a while we charm an operations person into agreeing with us. So,
yeah. When I used to do, labor relations, you know, it's often in negotiations, right? You know, you have the operations person, you have the union, and you have HR, and you everybody has their own agenda, just like in negotiations, but like in a grievance procedure and stuff. And, you know, I mean, sometimes you just get, you know, not as often as people think, and I think a lot of times, you know, bad leaders pretend this, but the truth is every now and then you just run into something where it's just a matter of principle, like literally, whether the person is misguided in their principle or not, some issue or some you know, something that's going on is just a matter of principle. And then, and so you may wind up with a client, I guess what I'm saying is, who's like, I don't care, you know, I don't care what the, not that I don't care what the law says, but I don't care what they say, this I'm not going to give in on this one. How do you, what do you do in that situation? Do you just have to say, okay, this is what I need to tell you, and then plow ahead and make the best of it? Or do you have some other techniques where you try to deal with somebody like that?
Well, I usually do two things. One is I find out who are the stakeholders for this particular issue. And if the person who has the very principled, if there is another communication route that I can take to either, you know, convince another individual in the organization as well and frame it a little bit that way. So, you know, for example, if I have an HR person who really believes that we need to be doing X and I think that that's not necessarily the right move or compliant, you know, I might bring in another manager that I've had a relationship or their supervisor of some sort and, you know, lay out, here is my position. And oftentimes, I don't necessarily want to bill them for that time, but I do want to, you know, CYA myself a little bit. You know, I don't want the client to go, well, didn't you have an attorney advise you on this? And they say, yeah, and she just didn't say I was doing anything wrong. I want to make sure that the stakeholders in the organization know what our legal opinion is to the extent that they're going to rely on that in the future. And that's a little bit of professional liability practice for myself, but it's also, and for my firm, but it's also, you know, if I'm not getting through to one person, if there is another individual who probably should know this, then that's what, how we'll have to handle that. And that, whether that's an in-house attorney or if it's someone else that I've hopefully met in the organization that might at least hear it. They don't need to take any action on it, but I need to protect myself and my firm when that kind of situation happens. The other thing that I do is I give examples. So if one individual, if a company wants to do X and another company, if there's a case or there's a board decision out there on this topic, I'll say, okay, well, here is an example. And I want to walk you through what this risk is for from this particular example, but also what this would mean to you. And my clients, I work with medium to small, medium, and large companies, but mostly in the medium size range. And when they hear about a board decision about something that was contrary to what they want to do, they're like, oh, my God, okay. So sometimes it takes a little bit of that persuasion. And for me, examples usually, are analogies work out really well and can get that message through.
Okay. This is off the wall question a little bit, but like in your firm, what's your typical client look like? Are you guys all over the map, or do you serve a particular sort of sector? Just I'm wondering if you're more medium sized business or all, small, large.
We serve all kinds. I think my smallest employment client has 10 employees, or between 5 and 10. They're a seasonal kind of employer, and then my largest has, you know, hundreds of thousands of employees. I tell you that my favorite type is the company that has had a lot of growth recently and they're really being successful, but then they realize, oh, my goodness, I need some help. And that's my favorite kind of situation to assist with, because then I know that they're invested in hearing from me and that I won't be the squeaky wheel over in the corner, most likely. But I can also give them some practical, you know, HR related, like, you know, have you thought about implementing some new, a new ATS system? You know, maybe we should move away from paper, or you're not implementing performance management. Maybe we should think about doing that. And when we have that kind of situation, I can help the client, you know, either find an outside consultant who can help them implement that, but we can kind of take a whole approach and to kind of, you know, bring everything at the clients and make the HR function work the way it's supposed to work, or the way we all ideally want it to work.
Yeah, it's way that's, more. Sorry, go ahead.
And that's when I have the most fun, and I think that I can have the biggest impact.
It's way more fun when you're working for a company that's, yeah, even if you're working as a retained partner, like, or an ally, yeah, as an attorney, but way more fun to work with them when they're growing and vibrant than it is when you're going the opposite direction with layoffs or facing all kinds of, you know, bad business challenges, because those are the tough, they're certainly challenging, but they're not nearly as fun and rewarding. So, we're halfway. Go ahead.
And in those situations, you know, you've got when it is doing the risk and stuff, it's just so emotional that it's hard to keep sight on what's best for the business in those situations. So that's what makes it so difficult.
Yeah. So it's halfway through the show. I mean, we have a 30-minute set today, and it's 1:15. So let me just do a quick reset. This is Drive Through HR. I'm Mike Vandervoort hosting, and to end the week and the first full week of December. And our guest today is Kate Bischoff. Kate's an attorney in Minneapolis, right? You live in the
yeah.
Twin Cities. And I don't think I ever did ask you to actually give your bio. Why don't you tell us where you're from, like literally where people can find you and that kind of stuff.
Okay, well, I will say because I am at the Minnesota Electrical Association convention today. I stepped up for this today. And I am the daughter of a construction industry. My family has a medium-sized electrical contracting company. And so when I started out as an attorney, I started out representing plaintiffs doing companies. And that was a complete shock to my family. Like, why would you work for the dark side? And so after two years, I switched. So now I represent management and a variety of different kinds of different companies, including a lot of construction companies. And then in the middle of my career, I took a complete whim. I wasn't failing at my job. I had always wanted to live overseas, and so I applied for the Foreign Service on a whim, and after a grueling 18 months of recruitment, I found myself in Jerusalem as the HR director for the Consulate General in Jerusalem, and then 2 years later as the HR officer for U.S. Embassy Zambia. And when my oldest son was having some trouble in school, I decided to come home.
Hmm. Well, that must have been. We should do a show about that sometime, because that would be, you know, I have never lived overseas. I love to travel, but I've never lived overseas, and that's one of my bucket list things. And we'll see. But I'm always fascinated by that. I lobbied very hard for an assignment in Japan once upon a time, but wound up not being able to make it happen for a variety of reasons. Not the least of which was I had a wife and two little kids at home, and I didn't speak Chinese, so there were a lot of factors against me. But anyway, that's cool. And so now you're with the firm, and you're giving great advice to your management side clients, and we've got some stuff coming up in the next. I mean, like every year everybody does all these year end shows, and I didn't really set this up as that, but there's a lot of stuff. The Obama administration in its final 2 years has just created a ton of new regulations, rules, and policies and stuff. And, you know, and we had a lot last year, and the onslaught continues this year. And I think even though 2016 is an election year, we're going to see a lot more during next year. So there's at least, you know, a handful of big things that I can think of right off the top of my head. The Department of Labor regulations altering FLSA. The NLRB changed quickie election rules earlier this year, and we're starting to see some of the impact there, which is mixed, and a couple other things. So I guess what I'd like to do in the last 10 minutes or so is just kind of get your thoughts on those things that you think, you know, employers coming into 2016, you know, what are your clients, I guess this is going back to the old script in some ways, going into 2016 and knowing all the things that are coming on the horizon, what are your clients worrying about right now, and what kind of advice are you giving them to kind of get them prepared?
Well, I think that the number one thing that my clients are concerned about is the new overtime regulations and setting the salary to $50,440 and what that will mean for all those white-collar exemptions out there, that now your charge nurse who is making $39,000 and had massive supervision requirements, and now she has been working 60 hours a week regularly to fill all that, now she's going to be entitled to overtime, and looking at that cost associated with the new salary threshold and what that will mean. And I think my clients are necessarily and appropriately a little freaked out about it. And so I'm starting to give a lot of, you know, take a deep breath, let's take a look and what this means, and kind of doing some kind of auditing to figure out what we should do going forward.
So, I worked most recently before I joined Q. I worked most recently at a retail grocer, and we had been dealing with classification issues for a long time, and I think they were pretty well prepared. But what are like three steps people could do right now, I guess, that you would, you know, for your client? What are three things that somebody should be thinking about right now related to that?
I don't know if I've got three exact steps, but I can give you my general overview. You know, we're coming up on W-2 season, right? So we're going to be looking at everybody's salary. Why don't we take a look right now? You know, the FLSA regulations, you know, I don't expect them to be implemented until July or even later. I think there's going to be enough challenge to them that it may not even be to the end of 2016 that they're going to be fully implemented. But, you know, we're coming up on looking at what the salaries were and look at the W-2s and see what they say and, you know, start there. That's the first place. And I think, you know, the Department of Labor thinks it's 5 million employees who will be affected by this. I'm not sure if that's going to be the right estimation, but I know for my clients, they don't care if it's 5 million, if it means 6 employees for them and
right.
what that cost can be associated. So to start, I recommend people start at the W-2 level. Look and see who this is going to be. And, you know, sometimes we have the information in our HRIS systems or HBM management systems, but, you know, we're going to need to find out what that number is. And so a good rule of thumb is to look at what the W-2 says, because that's a good place to start, because it's going to include all the other bonuses and stuff that may or may not be included in that salary amount. So start there. The next is, okay, we know who we've identified who is at this threshold or lower than this threshold level. You know, what do we think they work a week? If we've classified them as exempt employees before, what we might not know anything about whether or not they've been working overtime. Is there any way we can tell? What can we ask them about how many hours a week they've been working? Or is that going to cause an issue? Or can we look at, you know, computer login times and stuff like that, so we can get a ballpark as to what this potential cost for overtime is going to be. And then another step is, once you've figured out what that potential cost could be, now you need to go to, you know, the executive management team of the organization and go, we either do or we don't have a problem. And because we're going to be implementing these ways, we need to look strategically of how we do these things. Is it possible that we're going to need to create more positions to lower this cost, or are we going to have to change job duties? You know, if someone who was making 39 had supervising 4 people, you know, do we maybe take that supervision piece of it away so that lessens their workload in some way? So kind of thinking, you know, find out what the doomsday number could be if there's going to be one, and then do we need to take a strategic look at the organization, and doesn't that need to change? Do we need more positions to lower this cost, or is there another way to alleviate this workload?
Right, and a lot of companies have I mean, I guess there's like, I'm going to back up on that. I guess there's like, to your point, you can change duties, you can hire more people, you could theoretically increase the pay depending on where you're at, the threshold. Terms of pay, you could increase the management pay so that they meet the threshold level and you can retain the exemption, or you can pay overtime, right? You know, you can also just pay time and a half and manage the overtime. And there's probably a few other strategies we didn't articulate there. Since it's not even in effect yet, are you seeing any indication of what employers are doing now, or are they still in the wait and see? I mean, the analysis seems almost like a no-brainer. But are you seeing companies make adjustments at this point, or are they still waiting to see the final before stuff is implemented, before they go kind of the final phases?
I don't think an employer who's sitting back thinking that the threshold number is going to change is making a strategic decision that is going to help them. I don't think the $50,440 is going to change. I think there's going to be pressure for that to change. But I think we need to start preparing for the inevitability of that number as the threshold, whether it's this this year or it's going to be coming down the pike. I think the Department of Labor has been pretty adamant that that's going to be the number. So I don't see them changing. I do, however, see them taking some input on what the actual exemption languages are and possibly changing the duties test, but I don't foresee them changing this number. So for my clients, they're looking at a bunch of different strategies of how to minimize this risk, and whether it's, you know, changing the organizational structure, giving employees raises to get over that threshold amount. But even just giving the raises, you know, my clients are looking at me like, that will be enough, right? I said, that'll be enough for this year. It might not be enough for the next year, because then the threshold number is now going to be tied to the BLS numbers, which means that inflation could have a role on what that threshold number is going forward. So I think my clients are taking a variety of different views on it. Are they trying to be strategic and trying to do the right thing for their organization and for their employees?
And of course that causes pain and consternation all over your clients' companies as you have those discussions, right?
There seems to be some blood on the table for sure.
Yeah. I saw, and I can't remember the organization that put it out, but I actually saw yesterday on Twitter sort of a headline, you know, a tweet headline, if you will, about a Twin Cities-based organization that I think is a worker center, and they released a report that I'm paraphrasing to some extent, but the title was "Wage Theft is Rampant in the Twin Cities." Okay, well, that'll get. I'm sure you're not familiar with what I'm talking about, but that seemed a little hyperbolic, because most employers are not willfully engaging in wage theft, because there's a ton of penalties, but more get caught than you would think, I guess, as well. Is it deliberate?
I don't think any of my clients are making mistakes or are engaging in willful wage theft. I think even clients who might not be paying overtime the correct way, you know, or calculating it the right way, they always are very well-intentioned. I don't think my clients are out to, you know, willfully screw the man, right? But I think, you know, Minneapolis has been getting a lot of attention, in particular because our city council is very active, floated the idea of getting rid of on-demand scheduling and requiring that employees get, a schedule at least a month ahead of time. And so we might not be San Francisco yet, but there certainly seems to be some movement towards $15 an hour as a minimum wage. What from a management side is kind of beneficial is that St. Paul doesn't necessarily always follow Minneapolis' steps. And there is a distinct rivalry between Minneapolis and St. Paul over who's going to get business. And I think that competition helps level the playing field a little bit so that we're never too liberal or too conservative on either part, so that we can compete with businesses on either side of the river.
Interesting. Minneapolis, when I worked up there, I didn't live there, but I worked, you know, as you know, for a company that's based near there, and it was a very interesting business center. Influences all over the place. And you're right. I see a lot of activity on the union side and around the issues driven stuff, not so much union organizing, but issues like you just mentioned, scheduling, paid leave, $15 an hour stuff. Mm-hmm. And there's quite a lot of, been quite a lot of activity amongst the Fight for 15 and a lot of different things up there. And I guess that kind of goes back to the roots of the city, all the way back to, you know, the political parties and stuff, which is cool. I mean, it's different. And I thought we'd talk about like three legal issues. We're down to our last minute.
Okay.
So,
oh, no.
Joe is rapidly dwindling away. We could go further, but I actually have another call that I have to get on in about a half an hour, and I need to prep for it. Not a show, but a work call. So I got to go do my day job. It's been a pleasure having you on again. You mentioned, you know, it's part of the genesis of the conversation, the first part about giving advice to clients. You mentioned that you had your firm had just put up a blog post, I guess. Where do people find your firm's blog and that kind of thing? And where can they find you on Twitter?
Okay, well, the blog is theemploymentlawnavigator.com, all one word. And we blog about a lot of stuff about employment law and particularly about how technology is impacting the workplace. So we talk a lot about that on the blog. And then I am massively in love with Twitter. So I tweet quite a bit, and you can find me at K8BishHRLaw. So really, you can't miss me. I feel like I'm way overexposed on Twitter, but I am massively in love with the platform.
The technology topic, you know, that's like I'm sitting here going, oh, we should have talked about this and talked because I
I'll throw a picture out. I am co-chairing a conference in March about people analytics because we're seeing so much big data and data analytics in human resources. And the group in Minnesota is called Mini Analytics. We're a group of 6,000 data scientists and geeks like me who are very fascinated with how analytics work. So we're looking forward to talking about this, particularly in HR, coming up in March.
And where? I know it's in Minneapolis, but where is it going to be held at? Do you know?
It's going to be at the University of St. Thomas, the Minneapolis campus. Yeah.
Cool.
And the group is Mini Analytics.
Can you send me on Twitter the details on that? That sounds fascinating.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Well, great. And so thanks for being on. Have a great Friday. I'm going to find a bit of music here, and I'm going to take us out. So enjoy the wintry weekend in Minnesota, Kate, and everybody else. Have a great weekend. Bye.
Thanks, Mike. Bye.